This week's episode was brought to you by the disembodied voices I hear scooping out pumpkins and the generous support of listeners like you. If you enjoy listening to The Whole Rabbit and still haven't been inducted into the ranks of shape-shifting rabbit wizard overlords from dimensions beyond space and time, please visit www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where your monthly donation of just $5 will get you instantaneous access to our entire library of extended episodes, which you can listen to in your podcast player of choice by using our exclusive RSS feed for subscribers. But that's not all. I'll send you a 5x5 vinyl sticker of our Baphometic bunny cover art and the secret keys to our Discord server, which, when combined together, unlock the occult network for communicating with other reality saboteurs from all over the universe. Warning, this week's episode is not for sensitive ears or people currently eating food, because we're discussing, in more detail than is healthy, the practical and impractical reasons that human beings eat other human beings. We explore the human flesh-eating tribes of the Caribbean, Papua New Guinea, and even the United Kingdom, to discuss the rituals, customs, and biology of why people consume each other. In the extended episode, we discuss the maladaptive individuals who enjoy eating people for fun, specifically Albert Fish, Vince Lee, Issei Sagawa, and Armin Mives, with a special guest appearance by Butt Naked. Thank you, everybody, and enjoy the show.
Beelzebug, he's like, eat me for
Beelzebug.
Did you have a Beetlejuice?
Oh, snap.
Oh, no.
I think I just ate Jeff Goldblum, you guys.
F in chat for Goldbug.
Was it consensual?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Whole Rabbit, where we don't just drink the blood and eat the flesh of the savior. Nay, we remove the guts, singe off all the hair, and cook it over banana leaves with hot rocks, serving the head full of delicious steamed brains to the person who found it, because this week, we're discussing cannibalism and revealing the chilling truth of why people eat each other. I'm your host, Luke Madrid, the Hack Rabbit. I'm joined this week by the fanged, flesh-rending Corgi Shock Trooper, Mari Sama.
Rar.
Malachor 5, the mysterious macerator of flesh.
My room smells like a super mutant lair.
And the tantalizingly taboo unicorn, Heka Astra.
Hello, it's a spadoinkle day.
The fuck is spadoinkle?
You ever see Cannibal the Musical?
I don't like musicals.
It's by Trey Parker and Matt Stone before they did South Park. It's an old trauma film. There's a song in there. Well, it's full of songs because it's a musical. But one of them is that it's a spadoinkle day. And spadoinkle means great.
What does a cannibal and a spider have in common?
What?
Both eight legs.
Oh.
I know.
I have to admit, I got a little bit faint researching for this episode like once or twice.
That's because you're a little bit squeamish.
I never used to be squeamish. What happened to me?
If I may say something at the start of this, of all ritualistic things to do, like eating presumably a dead person, right? That's
well,
pretty fucking extreme.
If they're lucky, they're dead first.
But even if they are dead first, by consuming them, they become alive again inside of you.
Right, because, you know, I'm on this podcast mainly because I'm into the occult and stuff, and the whole idea of eating somebody for a ritual, that's too far for me. I won't do that ever.
But if it was part of your culture and you just grew up with that?
Then you would obviously be okay with it.
Obviously, I would.
So are we conditioned to be like, cannibalism is weird? Or do you think it's an innate kind of taboo?
I think it's innate to stop disease. Because if you think, like, pigs can eat themselves, but they're also, like, highly immune to most disease. But then, you know, most animals, if they consume their own for too long, they become, like, really, really sick.
I mean, they do typically say it's a dog-eat-dog world. Nature does understand this whole thing a whole different way. You know, you got to eat. You're going to eat something. You know, sorry if it's you.
Not to say that it wouldn't happen in extenuating circumstances, but I don't think humans are naturally inclined to just eat their own kind all the time.
Right.
They are definitely capable of it and will do it to survive.
Why don't we talk a little bit about the word cannibalism? It's not the only way to say, you know, eating another person. Anthropophagy is another way to say it.
The word cannibalism owes to the Spanish conquests of the native people of the Caribbean islands. When Christopher Columbus landed in the Antilles, he found the gentle Arawak people to be pleasant, inviting, and even once dubbed them the best people on earth. The picture Columbus painted was that of the noble savage, a charming, cereal-eating, indolent, and kind people who were welcoming of their conquerors. in drastic contrast to these Arawaks were, supposedly, the Carib invaders, who were described in equally naive terms as ferocious, warlike, human-eating savages, like me. Today, we know the Carib people were not particularly violent when compared to their neighbors, who, just like them, consumed small pieces of their wartime enemies to ritualize a victory. Jacinta de Carvajal, in 17th century, addresses this prolific Spanish myth that natives subsisted on human flesh alone, when he describes their cannibalism as part of an initiation ritual for Carib warriors, and then emphasizing their normal diet as a matter of record.
The ordinary food of the Caribs is cassava, banana, fish, and game. They eat human flesh when they are at war, and do so as a sign of victory, not as food.
Of the initiation ritual, Jacinto records that during the ceremony, the prospective Carib warrior has to kill 3 Ititos, an enemy tribe member, with his own hands. The head, arms, and ribs of the vanquished enemies would be made into trophies. Afterwards, initiates would follow a restricted diet of water, manioc, and tobacco juice for 6 months before ritually killing and consuming another itoto at a giant festival.
Man, I guess after eating all that for like, what, month, like a half a year, probably man leg would look really good to you.
I was thinking about that. Tobacco juice? You'd be like,
ugh,
ramped up all the time.
Yeah, but it's also kind of like, you know when people chew tobacco?
I was about to say that.
You're never supposed to swallow it because it makes you vomit all the time. Like if you, I can't imagine just drinking it. That's like, it reminds me of like the initiation ritual for pot smokers where they tell the new person to like drink the bong water and they'll get super high and they always just like throw up.
It's so gross.
You have to if it's a newbie.
But it's, yeah, it's like getting the spit can in the saloon and then like is basically...
Oh, stop.
that's gross. We're about to talk about people eating each other. And
ugh, I know, but that's making my stomach retch.
Well, let that be the appetizer.
I don't know why, but that actually grosses me out more than cannibalism does.
Me too.
The Spanish myth of rampant native cannibalism truly began when Columbus returned to Queen Isabella, reporting on his many findings, specifically on the friendly Arawaks and the brutal man-eating caniba, as he incorrectly called them. Later, Spanish settlers would correct it to Carib, and only recently have archaeologists confirmed that these Carib even existed that far north. Nonetheless, the term cannibal stuck and became a convenient label for any native people who could now be justified in conquering. Similar to how the United States uses the term terrorist. Likewise, by framing the natives as cannibals, the Spanish were able to dispense with their vision of coercing the natives into paid employment and just begin robbing, torturing, enslaving, and murdering them instead. Nonetheless, cannibalism as a practice is well recorded as an artifact of many cultures all over the world, and extends even further into the animal kingdom than we once believed. I couldn't help but begin to speculate if perhaps the Spanish, especially the clergy, were horrified by the ritual cannibalism of the natives because it so perfectly mirrored one of the highest and most sacred mysteries of Catholicism, the ritual consumption of Christ's body and blood in the form of the Eucharist.
Yeah, I always found that creepy when I was a kid.
And it's a completely valid point because I think I mentioned it when we were talking about Day of the Dead about a year ago. I was talking about how in these war times when the dead were slain and, you know, the Spaniards, I think, were burning the bodies or something, the natives were like, you're not going to eat that. Like, you know, that blood, all that stuff belongs to the gods. Like, it's for us to use in ceremony, not to just be spilled on the battle. Oh, I guess that's when the Spaniards started killing them. These natives felt really offended when they weren't consuming their, you know, the enemy's dead. These white people were just kind of burning them. And they were like, fuck, you're really just not putting us where we belong. And culture-wise.
What a waste.
Yeah.
Who's the real savages, huh?
Either way, it's brutal. But they were like, what a waste of blood.
It does kind of make sense, though, if the blood is already, you know, if the person has already been killed. Blood is precious. It's your life fluid.
Yeah, waste not, want not, right?
It really is sacred, yeah.
Which brings us to the question, why do people eat each other? In Angels and Demons of the New Millennium, Lon Milo Duquette suggests that during the Age of Leo, which occurred around 10,000 BC, while humans lived as hunter-gatherers, kingship and deification was imparted upon those who could best kill during the hunt and provide their people. During this time, worship of animals and spirits of the hunt dominated. By hunting the sacred animal, the hunter, and by extension the tribe, would grow stronger with its power. This is around the time we find all those
Venus of Willendorf, like Barbie hand statues, which meant they were also deifying the goddess, and they saw the animals and the plants as an extension of this goddess.
That's pretty valid with my point of view.
So as Neolithic hunting is a high-risk activity, often the hunter king, the strongest of the bunch, would meet their end on a hunt, leaving the tribe wanting for their strength and maybe even a fresh meal. This made the ritual consumption of the sacrificial body of the dying or dead god king a natural choice, with both religious and practical significance. Lon describes how the hunter king was deified as a consort of nature, which makes sense considering their tribal role, and they were depicted riding bulls or panthers to represent the harnessed yet untamed power of nature. Furthermore, this is how the bull became a ubiquitous symbol of kingship, divinity, and sacrifice all over the world, from Baal to Apis to Mithras to Serapis to Jesus to Kylo Ren and back again. Eventually, the bull god would tire of needing to be slain for the goddess at the end of his term, and each year a substitute would be given in his place. Usually a virgin boy, which in Christianity is symbolized by a lamb.
Sounds sus.
Eat the cracker, right, Mari.
Yeah, I think there was some Bible kid on Oprah one time, and they're like, why are you yelling Bible verses? He's like, in the Bible, it says to raise your voice when you, he's like, eyes are bulging out.
Oh, jeez.
I love those kinds of Christians.
Just, they got the spirit in them, don't they?
They just bring me so much joy in this world that God made.
They're cannibals. You have to eat the body and blood of a sacrificial murder victim that's been tortured to death in order to gain acceptance into the giant sky tribe.
I'll do whatever Jesus tells me to do.
Have you accepted Jesus as your Lord and Savior in your mouth?
Which part of Jesus do you think?
My whole body is covered in the blood of...
You guys.
Don't you put it in your mouth. Don't you put it in your mouth. Till you ask someone you love. Till you ask someone you love.
Whoa.
Whoa.
Sorry, I just turned into a goose.
Did you have an aneurysm?
You just cut out. I just heard like a hat.
You guys want to talk about mortuary cannibalism now?
Oh, Lord. I wish Dingus was here for this. Yeah, he works for a mortuary, which is perfect, honestly.
Picks up the bodies and delivers them.
Yeah.
So some cultures have practiced mortuary cannibalism, which is the eating of dead bodies as a funerary rite for their loved ones. This practice was done out of love and respect for the deceased so that they may not rot away or become food for insects and animals. And likewise, the consumption of their bodies would protect the deceased from harmful or opportunistic spirits. So one example of this is the Wari people of Rondônia, Brazil. They practiced mortuary cannibalism of their kin up until 1961, when the U.S. evangelical missionaries of the New Tribes Mission showed up and established burial sites. In modern times, they no longer practice the cannibalism part. They bury their dead instead. However, they still practice certain rituals that are native to their culture. In the past, though, the deceased would be placed on a stilt palm platform for 2 or 3 days, where the family and loved ones could hug and hold the deceased, or place themselves under the body. The kin of the deceased would cry, sing, crouch, and walk around the body, and during this time, others would prepare a fire for the body to be cooked on. Once the body was cooked, it would be offered in small pieces to non-kin to be eaten gently with care, using chopsticks. So the eating of the body shows to those mourning the deceased that it is no longer a person, but simply a body. Their soul has gone to the underwater world. The family would ask others to eat the body because the sight of it provoked longing and grief. So it was considered poor conduct for those who did eat the body to show any form of delight or pleasure in the eating of it. So it's still a grievance process, a mourning process. It was hoped that all the flesh of the body would be eaten in that way, and whatever might remain would be thrown into the fire to complete the disappearance of the corpse. The complete disappearance of the corpse was really important, and it also involved anything belonging to that person. So other physical things that were dear to them would also be put in the fire. If they had lovingly touched the hair of loved ones, then the loved ones would shave their heads and throw the hair into the fire along with the bones of the deceased and their possessions.
Can't take it with you. Well, actually.
So in modern times, the Wari people don't practice the mortuary cannibalism. Instead, they spend a night and a day mourning with a body in an open coffin. But they do, however, still practice some of the old rituals. So sometimes they'll still take the body out and lay it on the floor. They'll slide themselves under the body, one by one, forming a kind of dog pile. And they, when they do this, they accept any and all fluids and scents that the corpse may offer to them.
Ugh.
Juicy.
Wow.
So if you're not familiar, that includes purge fluid, which comes out of orifices of the body, mouths, nose, ears, other places.
Oh, look, kids. Granny got some of Uncle Norbert's juices on her. Oh, it smells so terrible. That's how we know that we love him.
I hear that stuff is like totally acrid too. Like,
it's really gross. It is
so
really gross.
Fucking gross.
They're full of love. That's why they're dripping.
I've done my fair share of taxidermy, and it's pretty gnarly, purge fluid. Energetically speaking, though, like from a cultural ritual kind of perspective, I guess this is kind of part of them saying goodbye. Like, any last interaction is considered like sacred and a blessing, even if it's putrid, because they get nothing more past this point, you know?
Yeah, even if it's cold, it's moving, and they're not supposed to be moving. So it's like somewhat of an extension of them that's still motion and energy thus. So it has some value, definitely, ritualistically, in my eyes. Would I eat it or drink it? No.
I'm pretty sure they definitely do not eat or drink purge fluid.
Yeah, that's gross. But I'm sure some cultures do. Somebody did in the past. I'm sure somebody did.
The Wari people aren't the only people that have practiced mortuary cannibalism. It's also been practiced in Papua New Guinea, and the Aztecs practiced it as well. In the Aztec culture, human sacrifices were said to be eaten after their sacrifice because they were considered to be sacred, like we were saying earlier.
Would they eat the heart when they cut it out? I mean, I'm assuming they would.
I think the heart is considered like the most sacred thing.
It sounds chewy.
Hearts are pretty chewy. I haven't personally eaten a heart. I've fed hearts to my dogs, though, and it's taken them a while to get through it because it's just muscle.
That's what you did with your ex-boyfriends?
Me?
Eat their heart out?
Feed it to your dogs?
Feed them to the doggo.
And your butt is the biggest muscle.
I have observed that tongues and hearts are very chewy, kind of. The tongue was kind of like a spongy, chewy.
Well, I know that. I have one in my mouth right now.
I've had beef tongue and chicken hearts before.
I tried a chicken heart once and it was not my jam.
Sometimes certain organs can like spurt when you try to cut them. Like, I think like kidneys, kind of spurty.
In the National Geographic documentary Eating with Cannibals, Piers Gibbons flies into remote regions of Papua New Guinea to ask the locals, the Karawai people, about the well-reported history of cannibalism in the area. After speaking with the elders of a few villages, including the greatly secluded Biami clan, he learned that cannibalism was far more prevalent in the past. In the case of nearly everybody he interviewed, the cannibalism was performed in response to claims of witchcraft. In one case, however, it was a wife and her best friend who were speaking poorly of the wife's dying husband. The dying husband responded by asking the village in earnest to kill and eat his wife, along with her friend, if he died. The tribe honored his wishes.
Oh my God.
Oh.
Wow.
That's love.
Hey, you guys.
Man, wouldn't you hate to find that in someone's will?
Hey, guys, if I die, make sure to kill and eat my wife and that bitch best friend of hers. Thank you.
The male warriors of the Biami, expert witch hunters they are, claim that men, women, and pigs are all butchered similarly and taste about the same. Humans are usually so big, however, their legs must be cooked separately. Elders of the Biami clan claim that human flesh was never consumed out of hunger, only out of justice.
Long pig.
Gross. Long pig. It's really long. You gotta cut it in half to cook the whole thing. Wow, it makes sense now. Prior to the 70s, none of the Karawai people had ever seen an outsider. As you might expect, there are still some clans who remain hostile to the idea of outsiders. One such group is the Letton, who, untouched by missionaries, can give us a clearer picture of why a suspected witch would be cannibalized. According to the Letton people, when a mysterious illness kills somebody, it is the work of a Kakua, who is a witch woman from the underworld. They say a Kakua possesses the body of a man, never a woman, and begins to magically eat their insides. Ethically, The correct thing to do is pay back the Kakua in kind. They must eat the Kakua as it ate the person who died, a form of vengeful justice. They also say human meat does not taste so much like pig as it does cassowary, and that brains are one of the best parts. This feature of the head belongs to the individual who found the Kakua.
They actually eat the brains of the person?
The person who found the witch, because they get the head, it's usually their honor to eat the brains because it's like the tastiest part. It's one of the most savored pieces of the human meat is the brain inside of the skull. It gets steamed, right? Yeah.
The brain meats.
I wonder if you get smarter from eating it.
What if you ate a dumb person?
Oh no.
So cannibalism that occurs within a localized tribe or family that involves the eating of a human from that tribe or family by others belonging to it is referred to as endocannibalism. The eating of a human that does not belong to that family or tribal community is called exocannibalism. So, for example, the eating of the flesh of your enemy would be exocannibalism. The Wari tribe that I talked about earlier are the only confirmed culture which has practiced both endo and exocannibalism.
This is important because when you're talking to a cannibal, you have to be correct with your pronouns.
I was going to say exocannibalism sounds like a great metal band name.
Cannibal Corpse.
Yeah.
The Byami claim that they don't eat people because witches, after all, they're not people.
So to them, it's exocannibalism, but to us, it's endocannibalism.
Right.
She's a witch. Eat her.
Well, speaking of endocannibalism, in 2001, archaeologists at the University of Bristol found evidence of Iron Age cannibalism in Gloucestershire down in a thick, muddy pit known as Fishmonger Swallet.
That sounds like a bloodborne area.
Oh, yeah. Fishmonger Swallet.
The remains of at least 7 human skeletons were found in the Swallet, and radiocarbon dating indicates that they're from the Iron Age, the early Roman period. At least one individual had been murdered, the rear of the skull smashed inwards, a femur from a female had been split open, and the marrow scooped out. This suggests cannibalism was being practiced as early as 2,000 years ago in Great Britain.
Scooped out. Nice and gentle.
Om nom 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 nom.
You forgot the yummy bits.
It's true. Bone marrow.
I'll be right back and we get my bone scraping spoon.
Besides this, medieval European culture had a number of medicines we might now consider cannibalistic. Mummy dust was made from ground up mummies, specifically from Egypt. But when demand became too high to be sustained on bona fide mummies, regular corpses from the cemetery were deceptive substitutes. Powdered or liquid blood was used for epilepsy. Human liver, gallstones, and oil from human brains was also used medicinally.
Side note here, some Enochian and like crazy modern magicians are like,
yeah, mummy dust is essential to creating the philosopher's stone, and it has to be from like a really good pharaoh
or something. They really believed in this shit back in the day.
They would rub it on wounds. They would take it for nausea. They did all sorts of bizarre, awful things with mummy dust.
Yeah, it did everything. It was like in every fucking magical potion that some asshole was lying to you about back in the day.
You know what would be most similar? Just really old leather. Like leather that's so old it's cracking.
Oh, and it's dust. It gets like that residue, or not residue, but like dusty aspect on the surfaces. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, like if you've ever had like something that's rawhide or like a veggie tan leather, something that's not dyed, the process of making it, if it's been traditionally processed, that's probably most similar to mummy dust than just grabbing a corpse out of the ground, unless they've been processed. Because there's so much on it and in it to preserve it. That it's not just human flesh.
You know, to go on a weird side note here, I wonder, because of your expertise, Hekka, if you were presented with like prime human leather samples, and what would your profession have to say about how to work with it and its qualities would be quite interesting.
Human leather would be very low quality leather. It'd be like pig leather, which is really only good for lining. Pig leather is the lowest quality of leather that you can get. It's really stretchy, it's thin, it's elasticy, it's porous. Our skin is a lot like that.
I hear people who do tattoos should practice on like pig carcasses because it's very similar to human skin.
Yeah.
Which is weird. Again, long pigs.
Long past pigs. In pre-modern medicine, the explanation given by the now discredited theory of humorism for cannibalism was that it came about within a black acrimonious humor, which, being lodged in the linings of the ventricle, produced the voracity for human flesh.
So do make sure to keep your black acrimonious humor well balanced, otherwise you'll start craving the bite from the flesh of my body.
Like a Dr. Octagon intro.
Medical cannibalism using human blood, flesh, or bones has actually been around for thousands of years. It wasn't a new thing by the time that it gained popularity. It was around in ancient China, India, and even Greece. Claudius Galenus was a 2nd century Greek physician that treated Roman gladiators, and he also wrote that the blood from a healthy person could cure that of an unhealthy person. He even went so far as to suggest that collecting the blood of fallen gladiators in a cup so you could drink it would be beneficial for you. This practice of collecting blood in a cup from slain people even persisted in places like Denmark up until the 1800s, where public executions would often mean people gathering around with cups in the hopes of being able to drink even just a little bit of hot, fresh convict juice.
Blue blood is the best. In the French Revolution, that was like, oh, we gotta get some of this royalty blood on us, because that's gonna cure...
It's gonna cure my gout!
It's funny, though, because they had some of the most unhealthy lifestyles, so... It's kind of a toss-up, but I would totally, like, be under the guillotine just waiting.
Let's just all wait around to drink some super unhealthy inbred royal's blood.
Trying to eat Marie Antoinette's toe jam.
I'd eat her boobs.
Good times.
I wonder what sort of medicine eating boobies imparts.
You eat healthy boobies, it makes your boobies more healthy. That's kind of the logic to it, isn't it?
I'll subscribe to that, sure.
What if you don't have boobies, but you want boobies, so you eat the boobies?
Eat the boobies you don't have.
There's a specific type of vor where the boobies actually do the eating.
Oh, that's no, like, no, 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 no.
What is vor? We'll save that for later.
It's like vagina dentata, but with boobs?
Yep.
So cannibalism for medicinal purposes, it peaked in its practice around the 15 and 1600s, but the practice, it lasted well into the 1800s. In 1656, Johann Schroeder, a German physician and pharmacologist, published a book called Pharmacopoeia Medico-Chymica, where among its various treatments and prescriptions, he included a recipe for DIY mummy powder.
Oh, would you like to tell us how to make some mummy powder?
Yep. So Schroeder, he had quite the penchant for prescribing mummy dust as a kind of cure-all for all kinds of diseases and illnesses. So in this book, he claims that the best quality mummies are, of course, those of the Egyptian variety. But Egyptian mummies are rare and expensive. So if you couldn't get your grubby, grave-robbing, mummy-fondling hands on one, then Johann, he had a solution for you. So he came up with a mummy alternative, which was more like seasoned alcoholic corpse powder. And he describes how to prepare this alcoholic marinated mummy in the Pharmacopoeia Medica, stating the following. Who wants to read how to make mummy dust?
Mari, go.
Okay. Take the fresh, unspotted cadaver of a red-headed man, because in them the blood is thinner and the flesh hence more excellent. Aged about 24, who has been executed and died a violent death. Let the corpse lie one day and night in the sun and moon, but the weather must be good. Cut the flesh in pieces and sprinkle it with myrrh and a little aloe. Then soak it in spirits of wine for several days. Hang it up against for 6 to 10 hours. Soak it again in spirits of wine and then let the pieces dry in a shady spot. Thus they will be similar to smoked meat and will not stink. Man, that sounds like a hella good salami.
Human salami?
Yeah, or there is some salami that's like cured in wine.
That does sound good. With non-human meats.
I don't know. It's kind of convincing me.
What about with some breast milk cheese? Honestly, it was less putrid than I expected, because you're putting it in alcohol and then drying it out, putting in alcohol, drying it out again.
I was going to bring up the Kuru disease, and it's common among the Fore people of Papua New Guinea, and it's translated as trembling. It's a neurological disease that has no cure. In the tribes where funerary cannibalism was practiced, this disease was said to be due to witchcraft or evil spirits. Eventually, doctors, they started to research the cause of this deadly disease. And they found that in their ritual, they would cook them and boil the brains and, you know, they would eat it, which was typically consumed by the women and children of these smaller tribes, where they would then, inside the brains, there's a strange protein that sometimes occurs. And it's, I'm not a doctor, so sorry if this sounds like really prions are basically proteins that are like a virus. And they're mainly found in the brain. and they're folded or they're misshapen.
They come unfolded and then they like cause harm around.
It eventually disrupts all the other proteins in the structure. All the other proteins end up, you know, messed up as well. And like I said, it's a neurological disorder. So it occurs in the brain, causes brain problems. Basically, it's a transferable protein that's like a virus. Like if this protein gets in you, it'll corrupt your system and eventually start messing you up. Kuru disease is pretty brutal. Its victims shake and they have bursts of laughter, which is pretty creepy. They eventually lose all coordination and they die from infections, from their not able to manage themselves, or pneumonia, which is again from their body not being able to kind of control itself. And it has a really long incubation period, which could be from within a few years, a decade, to making systems known with all the way up to 50 years. But once the symptoms start, it's within 14 months and you're dead. It doesn't only happen in this region, as prion transfer can happen in other ways, but this is just one that's, you know, if you eat a brain of a dead person boiled and cooked, it can give you this transference of, you know, protein degeneration, neurological disease. And this was done in their ritual, so it was common among these foray group.
There's a few diseases that are like that. People are probably most familiar with mad cow disease.
Yes. It's because they were feeding cows lamb brains, and the lamb brains contain a prion that's the same pretty much as the cows. So when they ate it, they were transferred and started killing livestock.
At one point, there was some kind of a water warning because there was fecal matter, I think, from infected cows upstream in the water. Some of these can be transferred not just by eating the brains, but also through other infected bodily excretions like fecal matter.
The thing with the Kuro too is as soon as that protein gets inside of your system, it'll start triggering all the proteins in your own brain to start unfolding.
Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease?
That's essentially what Kuro is.
So it's a prion disease that affects humans.
So we share the same kind of proteins that they have, because like, and it's really interesting to me too, because it's not spread by like bacteria or virus or any of that. It's just if another protein literally comes in contact with the unfolded protein, it just starts a domino effect. It's very terrifying.
It's not the only one that can affect humans either. There's also scrapie and chronic wasting disease. Those are also prion diseases.
Oh.
You can't cook it out of your food. You can't microwave it out of your food. You can't chemically treat it out. It's there. If it's in there, it's there.
Yeah. Cooking does not kill the prions. And so if you were going to cannibalize somebody that was infected with a prion disease, if you were to eat their brain meats, I like the word brain meats. If you were to eat those, you would be at very, very high risks for infection.
Doesn't it also just spontaneously happen if someone eats, like if someone is a cannibal for a long enough time? Or is it just per chance they come in contact with that?
That's how you avoid this, is because other humans contain, you know, typically you're going to eat a dead human or it's going to be a dead protein and it morphs and it's weird. Basically, the way to avoid this disease, don't eat other people. That's literally what the clinical advice is. That's what doctors will tell you. The only way you get this is from eating people. Don't do it. Mainly the brain.
Although they do say that people who do it traditionally can gain an immunity to those types of prions.
Oh.
It's not just humans as well. It's cows, sheep, deer, elk. They can all have prion-related diseases. And you don't even have to eat the brains. If there is a cross-contamination between the brains or the spinal fluids and the meat, if you eat that, you can still get it. There's usually pretty strict regulations for butchering, from what I know about it. And that's to minimize as much as possible the risk of cross-contamination with prion diseases.
Any trained butcher will know how to not make their meat tainted, basically.
Don't eat your friend's brains.
I can smell your brains.
If someone wants to give you some brains, make sure it's fellatio first.
It's a vicious cycle for these people, though. It's a vicious cycle because they were trying to free the soul and the spirit of their loved one by consuming this and cooking it. So it persisted for a long time. And this disease went all the way into the modern age because, it took up to fucking 50 years to incubate. And not to scare anybody, but you could have a dormant fucking protein in your body right now. And you might even die from it eventually. But if you live long enough, it might kill you. It's just the way it is. How scary is that?
Yeah, that's a really, really long incubation period, up to 50 years.
Yeah, you ate some funky meat that one time and you're done 50 years later. Crazy.
Life is short, so live fast and eat dim sum. I really love any biology related stuff personally.
Me too.
So it isn't just historic humans that have practiced cannibalism, because even the prehistoric Neanderthals cannibalized each other. So they were most definitely skilled hunter-gatherers, but it also seems that perhaps maybe when pickings were slim, they ate each other or they're dead. The bones of a newborn baby, a child, and four adult Neanderthals were discovered in a cave in Goyette, Belgium, and they showed signs of tool marks. The markings suggest the deliberate disarticulation and removal of their flesh by other Neanderthals. The bones were also fractured to extract bone marrow, and this isn't the only evidence found for Neanderthal cannibalism either. Other archaeological sites show very similar findings. In France, similar findings were uncovered in the Moulin-Guercy cave, where the bones of Neanderthals were found mixed in with the bones of other animals, like deer, and they showed the exact same treatment of butchering that would have been given to any other animal to be eaten. It also makes sense if one of their tribal members died to eat it before, you know, wolves show up or other animals show up to eat them, because they'll smell it, right? They will smell it and they'll come for it. So
yeah, and then someone else could be killed too, you know.
What if your culture just didn't think of burying the dead and they're like, no, we just eat them, like, that's how we deal with the body. You know, what if they just didn't think of that?
Well, like the Wari people didn't bury their dead until the 1960s.
When the missionaries showed up and were like, no.
Or maybe they tried burning it and then someone was just like, damn, that smells so good.
Well, hominids they're obviously not the only cannibalistic organisms to walk the earth, right? Plenty of other species take part in the consumption of their own kind. One example is cockroaches. They eat their dead. And when they die, they emit oleic acid, which can be smelled by other cockroaches from a really long distance. So they'll come looking for their deceased to cannibalize. So the more you stomp on them, the more you're attracting others from afar. And then there's filial cannibalism. So that's also a common practice in nature. And it's when one of the parents eats their offspring. And this often happens because the offspring is not viable, or to ensure the survival of the rest of the offspring by thinning out what will require nourishment, which is the surviving offspring. And it also provides a much needed resource for the mother to care for what's left of her offspring. I had a rat when I was about 20 years old, and she had oops babies with her brother, and she ate all of her babies. It's like she just knew, like, no, these are weird inbred babies and I'm just gonna eat all of them. So I kept finding half-eaten baby rats in her cage. That was one of my first real tests for embalming, actually, was when I found those little baby rats, because I kept finding them. Once I found two torsos, and I sewed them together to make these weird Siamese twin looking guys and suspended them in a jar in methyl hydrate, like some weird freak show attraction jar. So you can use methyl hydrate in place of formaldehyde if you need to. Fun tip.
One of the more interesting versions of cannibalism in nature occurs in the womb of sharks. The first shark to grow large enough to start eating in the womb will eat most of its siblings and leave usually one other one.
Just like Luke did. Luke, you ate your twin, right?
Yep.
Well, it happens in humans apparently too, but it happens in sharks, and they're born in a vicious world, because actually it's very common for sharks to do this. Luke, you might be a shark.
Just keep swimming.
I think my Sheba's a shark.
This brings us to sexual cannibalism. Now,
oh, does it?
It does.
Yes.
Because we're talking about the womb?
Sharks are sexy.
Well, sexual cannibalism is when an animal, usually the female, cannibalizes its mate prior to, during, or after copulation. The praying mantis, black widow spider, and jumping spider are a number of species that devour their mates. Sexual cannibalism is also found in other invertebrates, including a relative of the praying mantis, the Chinese mantis, and scorpions. In the case of the brown widow spider, they wiggle their butts in front of the lady's fangs during mating, giving themselves as a sacrifice. The male redback spider even does a sort of somersault into his mate's mouth. After all, the ones who do have twice as many children.
So goth mommy is real?
Confirmed.
Damn, I love it.
Of course, this is not the prerogative of all male spiders. In fact, the male nursery web spider will tie the legs of their prospective mates with silk prior to mating, something that researchers have termed
A bridal veil.
Kinky.
Ooh, she's going to get you.
The strategy. Bondage.
Oh, yeah, that too.
This strategy not only protects the male against being eaten, it also lets the mate for longer, increasing the chances of having offspring. The males who do this are much more likely to survive.
Or just tire up. I just love that.
Now, unless you're listening to the extended show, most human beings don't practice sexual cannibalism. But the idea of consuming their partner, or perhaps being consumed themselves, is a popular fetish.
You don't say.
Officially, it's known as vororophilia. Vororophilia is an infrequently presenting paraphilia characterized by the erotic desire to consume or to be consumed by another person or creature.
That's me.
The word vororophilia is derived from the Latin vorare, to swallow or devour, and the ancient Greek phila, for love. The fantasy usually involves the victim being swallowed whole, though occasionally the victims are chewed up and digestion may or may not be involved. Vor fantasies are separated from sexual cannibalism because the living victim is normally swallowed whole. The consumer is sometimes human, but animals, dragons, giant snakes, and other creatures can also appear frequently in these fantasies. After consumption, the enlarged belly of the consumer is often described with great care. Vor is more often enjoyed through pictures, stories, videos, and video games, and it can appear in mainstream media. In some cases, vorophilia may be described in a variation of macrophilia and may combine with other paraphilias. Apart from macrophilia, vor fantasies often have themes of BDSM, microphilia, pregnancy fetishism, anthropomorphized animals, unbirthing, a desire to be swallowed whole into the vagina and returned to the uterus, and finally, sexual cannibalism.
Oh, myrrh.
Sounds like a bunch of pussies if they think that's wrong.
I don't know. Like, I'm extremely familiar with this fetish because I think I've drawn some of it before for commissions. But yeah, furries love vor. And yeah, it's usually like a fantasy of either being in someone's mouth or you're in their stomach. You know how like in the old cartoons, the cartoon's just sitting in the stomach acid inside the stomach and there's like, it's like a joke or something.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently that's makes some people excited.
Is this like people who get turned on by the Jonah and the whale kind of stories?
I mean, maybe that's probably like the oldest story I could think of that actually depicts that, where you can like walk around and like build a fort and stuff inside of someone's stomach, like that you could just like live there.
I just want a nice warm place to be safe, you know, and if goth mommy wants to do that for me, then let her.
Oh, geez. But yeah, usually all of these stories, from what I've seen, is that the victim continues to live inside of the devourer. You're devoured whole and you can actually still function inside of them, which is the fetish.
That kind of seems like a return to womb fetish.
It's similar, yeah.
Pretty Lovecraftian too. It's like this big eldritch thing just like consuming the world and we all live in it.
Well, to bring it full circle, we've happened upon two enormous symbols to the Christian mysteries that involve topics we've talked about today. First, you have the Eucharist, where you have to consume the Savior, God, King, in order for yourself to be a part of the great clan in the sky.
To be saved from the outer darkness of the others who were not invited to the glowing fire of God's eternal grace.
But also the symbol of the fish, because as we've discussed in former episodes, the fish also is a symbolic representation of the whale, and this whale owes itself to older mythology, which involves being swallowed, consumed entirely, and that this is a larger metaphor for being swallowed by God. So these two themes, swallowing God and being swallowed by God, are something that are so deeply rooted in our own culture, we hardly even think about it.
It's like divinity and purity consuming and being consumed by, like at one with.
But if you'd like to hear the rest of the show, where we talk about the people who took that idea to the realm of the literal and actually ate their victims and then lived to tell about it, please visit www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where your monthly donation of just $5 will get you access to our entire library of extended shows, doubling the Whole Rabbit content. I'll even send you a 5x5 vinyl sticker of our cover art at no additional cost to you, and you'll get the secret keys to our Discord server, where you can talk to us about, I don't want to invite people to talk about eating breasticles, you know, but like, it's a fun thing to promise people, you know, like, but maybe don't talk about eating breasticles. Thank you, everybody. Please like, subscribe, and share. But most importantly, eat carrots and shoot lasers.
Pew, pew, pew.